You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast, and I'm Adam Rappaport. All right, this week we have on the newest member of the BA Test Kitchen, Sola L. Whaley, and she's talking about her recent and most excellent recipe for chicken biryani. It's based on her mom's recipe, and it took, let's just say, quite a bit of evolving and developing to get it to the finish line, but it is amazing, and you should definitely make it. After that, associate editor Hillary Cadigan chats with Donny Sirisavath, chef and owner of Cow Noodle Shop in Dallas, our number two best new restaurant in America, which we announced in our Hot 10 issue back in October. Donny's late mother taught him how to run a restaurant and cook Laotian food, and despite the fact that he took a very roundabout road to get there, he is now doing something very special. All right, let's do this. Sola, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here.
But you just took your headphones off.
It was just so many voices, like hearing my own voice on top of my voice.
There's literally voices in your head.
Too many. There's already enough. I don't need any more.
All right, your first time in the pod, talking about a recipe that I personally am very excited about. And I think a lot of people on staff are. I'm not going to pronounce it because I've heard you say it so many times in the test kitchen. Every time I'm like, I'm saying it wrong.
I think I'm saying it wrong.
You're saying it wrong.
I'm pretty sure I'm saying it wrong.
All right, go ahead.
I say biryani.
No, you didn't say it like that.
Biryani. Biryani. I just say biryani instead of biryani. I think it's supposed to be biryani, but I just...
How does your mom say it?
I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll have to FaceTime her. Okay, so this is one of those recipes that there are certain recipes that are being developed in the test kitchen that when they come out for a presentation, people are like, ooh, what's going on there? I feel like every time you brought the big pot out of the oven and took the lid off, it sort of seized everybody's attention.
Yeah, I guess it's a very dramatic dish, and it does look like just it looks like a literal mountain of food. So that gets your attention.
I remember the first time you actually took it out of the pot and plated it, we're like, wait, all of that rice and chicken and potato, all that stuff was in that one pot?
Yeah, it feels like the Mary Poppins bag trick where just things keep coming out and we're like, oh, there's pineapple in there.
You're like, oh my gosh. So, all right, so talk us through it in terms of, it was an interesting evolution about where this recipe started and then where ultimately you ended up when it was ready for publication.
Well, I didn't want to make this recipe at all.
You're not supposed to tell the listeners that. No, go ahead.
I guess Molly overheard me talking about my mom's lamb biryani, and so her and Sasha kind of ganged up on me from both sides.
Wow. Tough place to work.
You know,
Sasha's the editor of bonappetit.com, so she's like, she's the one who's responsible for making the lineups and everything. And
yeah, so between the editorial and the test kitchen, both telling me to make this, I guess I had to. I warned them from the beginning that it's really hard, and it's one of those recipes where no matter how good the recipe's written, it just takes practice.
Yeah.
So that kind of recipe is always scary to put out because no matter what you do, it could still get messed up when people make it at home.
Well, I think what's interesting about this recipe is, and we'll get to the finish line, but even the recipe as is for chicken thigh biryani, not lamb, there's not that many ingredients, but there's a lot of sort of nuanced technique that you write about in the step-by-step. And I think it's well done. But yeah, so you started with lamb, but that's not where we ended up. What happened?
Well, I felt like lamb would be too hard, first of all, because it's just starting with getting the lamb is difficult. It's going to require you to go to the butcher and ask them to cut it for you a specific way.
Is it lamb shoulder?
It's lamb leg cut into, bone-in lamb leg cut into 2-inch pieces with the bone in, which is an unfamiliar cut. So every time I go to the butcher, it's a little bit of a challenge just to get them to cut it for me correctly. And then they usually cut it too small. So if you get unlucky and you get pieces that are too small, they'll overcook.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to write a recipe for a cut of meat that you have to like ask people to go out and seek out. So that's step one, that's hard. Already first barrier to entry. And then after that, you have to brine the lamb before cooking it. And then also it cooks for much longer. So there's just a lot of areas in the cook time where you can mess it up because it's kind of a one and done thing. Like you can't go back and fix it.
Yeah. But I think this is helpful in terms of how the test kitchen works. And that one thing I so often talk to the Test Kitchen Editor is about is how do we make a dish cookable for the home cook? How do we make it something that, not only do they want to make, but they can make? So sometimes you have to go through that process before you even start developing.
Yeah. That's why switching to chicken thighs felt like, right off the bat, that makes it just so much more accessible to people. That's a cut of meat that you can find anywhere and...
Buy a pack at the grocery store, come home, start cooking.
And then you can start cooking.
So did you... Was it a one-to-one substitution? What was the first iteration of the recipe like using chicken instead of lamb?
Well, the first iteration I did, I just took my mom's exact recipe and tried it with chicken, and it was terrible. Just
like literally terrible?
It was so bad. Like, you should have seen Chris's face when he tasted it. He was so confused by what this horrible thing.
Like, why so bad? What went wrong?
The lamb one has a lot of strong spices because the lamb can take it. So it has mace, nutmeg, cubeb pepper, shad, jeera, like black cumin, all of these really, really powerful things, allspice, star anise, and it just kind of punches you in the face when it's on chicken.
Yeah, like lamb is such a hearty, aggressive flavor, but then chicken's more recessive.
Yeah, so I had to completely rethink the spice blend for chicken.
Okay, so that's your first year. Like, all right, chicken spices aren't working, so what did you then, what happened then? You're like, okay, what am I going to get to?
There were a lot of versions of this, and then I just kept tweaking the spice blend to keep in the same family of my mom's lamb one, and I just wanted to, like, pay respect to that, so I kept tweaking and tweaking, and no matter what I did, it was just bad. And then...
Like, how many iterations are we talking here?
I feel like I can't tell you because Marty's going to get mad at me for spending too much money on chicken.
Marty is Cristina Martinez, our director of operations, a.k.a. She keeps the books and she keeps the books tightly.
Keeps the trains running.
We'll say multiple.
Multiple. But then finally, like, I was just getting really sad and Chris told me to just go... let loose, be free, and just, like, start over and make my own. I, like, stop trying to mimic my mom's and just, like, you know.
Yeah.
Find my own beer on his
time to leave home. Time to spread your wings.
Spread my wings. And then I decided to go with my mom's korma spices. Her korma chicken is my favorite chicken recipe. So I guess I didn't totally find my own voice.
You said you stayed home, but you moved into a different bedroom.
Yeah, I'm in the basement now, I guess. All grown up in the basement.
So what's it? Yeah. So how different? What's that seasoning process?
So korma is one of the most, like, simple chicken recipes. I feel like it's the chicken you most often have growing up if you're desi. And it's just like a few warm spices: cinnamon, cardamom, black pepper. That's it.
And you're marinating the chicken.
Marinate the chicken in yogurt, those spices, a little ginger and garlic, and that's it. And then you normally, for a korma, would stew that all together. But instead of that, I just put that marinated chicken at the bottom of the pot and then layered.
Question before we get to the pot. You remove the skin from the thighs. Is that because it would just get all kind of flabby if it was braising?
Yeah, all of those, traditionally those stewed chicken dishes have the skin removed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, I have to bring up the potatoes.
Oh, I forgot about the potatoes. Oh, yeah. That was so bad.
They didn't make the cut either. What happened with the potato? Because the original dish is lamb, potatoes, rice, nuts, some dried fruit, etc.
Yeah.
Potatoes got left on the wayside.
Yeah, so the potatoes was really challenging. So my mom's lamb biryani has a layer of potatoes between the lamb and rice. And somehow when it all steams together, the potato's, like, perfectly fluffy. And she told me that she just, like, kind of lightly sears the potato before putting it in the pot, not cooking it all the way through, just, like, par cooking, and then it all steams together. And she made it sound so simple. But it was really difficult because if you overcook it, it turns into mush. And then if you undercook it, it's raw. And I just thought, like...
I stopped by during one of the undercooked.
You had
sessions.
One of the raw potatoes. And even sometimes I had in one pot an overcooked and an undercooked potato. So...
For her to get the lamb at the right doneness and the potatoes and the rice.
And the rice, yeah.
Sorry. So you're like, you know what? No lamb, no potatoes. Subbing in chicken. Marinate the chicken. Some spices and yogurt. Pretty simple so far. Mm-hmm. Are you ready to start cooking? How do you overnight marinade? Does it matter?
Overnight is best. Yeah.
Okay. So what you did in just a basic Dutch oven, nice big round one.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the first step when you're ready to start cooking?
Your chicken is marinated, right? And now you have to parboil your rice. This is probably the most important part because the only constant in any biryani recipe is the rice.
You and Andy Baragani would say that you should buy good basmati rice.
Oh,
and there
right.
is a difference between just the random stuff you get at your local grocery store and like the good stuff.
Yes, yes. Okay, yeah. Just like with the lamb, it starts with sourcing. Finding really good basmati rice is very hard in America. There's a lot of weird stuff in the grocery stores like jasmati.
Yeah, there's all the Texamati.
Texamati. I see that one. None of those things will work. You have to get like a really good, extra long, aged basmati.
Yeah, so when they're aged, you said the color, it's going to look more golden than mm-hmm. white.
Yeah, when it's aged, it does, the color changes. It's like deeper in hue, but more importantly, the aroma is much stronger. Like you don't get that characteristic nutty basmati aroma unless it's aged. And then it's very forgiving when you cook it up. It can withstand the long cook time of biryani. Like you could steam it for 45 minutes or 4 hours and it'll still be like fluffy, distinct grains. It maintains like a nice bite. When I tested with just your regular unaged basmati, I also tried it with the jasmati. With the jasmati, first of all, it was crazy because the rice looked like it exploded when I opened up the pot. It overcooked so much that it turned inside out.
Wow.
And then all of the other like standard unaged basmati would break just into little pieces. So all of your hard work feels like, oh, I just made a porridge. Why?
So are you saying I have to get where do I get the good stuff?
Like, the good stuff, yeah. You're going to have to go to a local like Indian store or Amazon.
Do I need like a password to the guy behind the counter and be like, hey man, I just want you, come on.
Just ask them for biryani rice.
Okay.
They'll know.
Okay, so you get the pot. So you're sauteing ghee, onions?
Well, you start by frying red onion and ghee. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, it's shallots, but we thought red onions are easier to find.
Sure.
You fry it until they're like crispy.
Yep.
It's going to be a crispy topping, but then you're also flavoring the ghee.
Oh, nice. Cool.
So
slotted spoon, take those out. Then you throw in a bunch of pistachios.
Mm-hmm. Or whatever nut you have.
Or not. And, and you get those going. And then you take those out because those are going to be toppings later, right?
Well, I used them as toppings to keep them nice and crunchy. But traditionally, it actually gets layered in the pot as well.
Okay.
But nobody liked that. It's just like you get a wet nut.
If you ask for an opinion in the BA test kitchen, you will get an opinion. Or five.
But it was a good point. Like, why do you want a wet nut?
That does not sound very enticing.
No.
Okay, so you got the ghee. There's been nuts in there. There's been shallots or red onions.
Yeah, so the ghee already tastes delicious. You've got this really good flavor base.
Yeah.
So fragrant. And then I sprinkle in a little sugar and get it caramelized.
Mm.
Korma always has a little bit of sweetness. And it also gives the chicken a nice color, so it's not just pale.
Yeah.
So that goes until it's very dark, actually, like smoking. Then I throw in the chicken, scrape in all the marinade, bring it to a simmer, and it's time to start layering. So at that point, I sprinkle on some of those frizzled onions, some dried fruit. I like to use prunes, but you can use whatever you want, really.
Apricots or something.
And then goes on the parboiled rice.
And the parboiled, so back to that, you're essentially, you're rinsing the rice, soaking.
We have to talk about the rice.
I feel like I'm on an Andy Bergotti podcast. All right, so you soak the rice in a bowl so the water's not cloudy, essentially?
Well, you want to rinse it. I like to rinse it not under a colander, but in a bowl.
Yep.
Because you really want to swish.
I do that. I learned that from Andy.
Swish.
Drain,
scrub
do
off
it again.
All that, yeah. Good aged basmati will run clear pretty quickly, after the second rinse, but the really bad stuff, you can rinse it forever and it'll be cloudy. I know. If I have time, I like to soak it. Soaking the rice for an hour or 2 hours helps it cook more evenly, and it prevents the grains from breaking because it's kind of, you're like easing it into hydration.
Like soaking beans and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, so you do that and then you parboil it in salted water?
Yes.
Like
so
boiling,
you want to get
salted
like
water,
really
like pasta style.
Raging boil of salted water,
nice.
Heavily salted. Pour all the rice in at once, and it's going to all sink to the bottom. So you want to give it a quick stir so it doesn't stick. And then you just have to stand there and stare at it, because the time it takes to parboil can be very, like,
wide. Yeah, you said
wide.
3 to 7 minutes, which is a pretty big window. So
it's
how
a
do
very
you,
big window.
What am I looking for to know that it's parboiled?
Well, a lot like al dente pasta, you want to bite into it and still see the hard white core.
Oh, so I'm like taking little grains out, biting into it.
I just stand over and I just bite a grain every minute.
Okay.
until you get there. You want it to like break easily, but still have a little bit in the core. The rice is going to double in size, essentially, and it kind of all rushes to the top.
Okay, so after about 5 minutes, you're draining that, and then you're layering that over the chicken slash frizzled onion slash dried fruit.
Mm-hmm.
You got that top base of rice, and then you do an interesting trick.
I do.
You do with like the, you're poking the
oh,
holes.
Oh, right,
in
then
the
you
rice.
Poke holes. You know the recipe better than me.
I read the recipe. I know. Well, I have to do that. Got to read. Got to do my homework.
Yeah, you poke holes to like allow the, so the curry underneath is going to start simmering, and the steam that creates is going to cook the rice.
Okay, and so you do like a long wooden spoon or something.
Wooden spoon, yeah. Finger, whatever yeah. you want. And then cover the pot. Are we at cover the pot yet?
Yeah, sure. So you starts to simmer.
Yeah, you wanna
gurgles. So, it gurgles.
Yeah. Well, normally they actually use a thin aluminum pot, and you have to seal the top with dough. Mm. But because we're doing it in a Dutch oven, which is so heavyweight, and like you put that lid on, and everything stays in. Yep. So you cover the pot, and then you wanna put it over like medium high heat until it starts to simmer. You'll hear it. You'll hear little bubbles. You'll see some steam coming out. You pop it in the oven and it goes
350.
350.
You bake for 45 minutes covered.
Bake it for 45.
Let it rest for at least 15 minutes or up to an hour.
Then yes.
You get your ta-da moment where you go, take the top off and it's like, it smells unbelievable.
It's like a very, the most important part is like being patient and not opening that lid.
Yeah.
Like once you close it, after the first time you put that lid on, you can't open it again.
And so when you're letting it rest, you're letting it rest with the cover
rest
on.
Covered. Yeah. It's going to finish cooking and rest. So it's like really important to just don't touch it.
So you like to plate it all together on one giant platter. Take it out, all out of the Dutch oven, plate it, rice on the bottom, chicken on top. Does it matter?
Yeah, well, yeah. There is like the plating of it is also very traditional and important. When they do like the giant vats of biryani, you actually use a big plate to plate, like use a big plate to scoop off the rice gently and transfer it to a big platter. And you want to do that without disturbing the second layer. Well, we only have two layers here, but imagine you have like eight.
Okay,
imagine if you have like eight layers.
You're going
layers.
Layer
you
by layer.
Like, take off one layer carefully.
Gotcha.
And then the next one. So then when you see the big pile, you can like see every distinct layer.
Yeah.
We just have two layers. It's not that difficult.
But you reserve those crunchy ghee toasted pistachios to sprinkle
on top. That's the finishing touch. You save some of those onions we fried right at the beginning. And top them off.
Sola, thank you so much. Chicken thigh biryani. Biryani. We better call your mom and find out.
Yeah.
You can find the recipe on bonappetit.com right now. Thanks so much, Sola.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi. I'm here today with Donny Siri Savat of Cow Noodle Shop, our number two best new restaurant in America.
Whoa.
Yeah. Were you expecting that to happen?
No. Like, you know, I'm like, is this a mistake? You guys made a mistake, right?
Even after like the 3-hour interview and then like your publicist trying to ask me when it was getting published. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I don't know. What are you talking about?
Yeah, everyone's kind of pretty good at keeping their, you know, lips shut.
Yeah. So we had the party this past weekend. Did you have a good time?
Oh my God, we had an amazing time. The whole crew came down, we just, you know, close up shop, you know, brought everybody down pretty much. Everybody.
How many people is that?
13 plus with our friends and family. So yeah,
awesome. You did it right.
Yeah.
What's been sort of the fallout now that you've, I mean, you know, being a best new restaurant is sort of, I mean, it's a blessing, but it's also a little bit of a curse.
Yeah, it is. You know, like the whole thing was 50, you know, top city, the number 10, and like, what? There's a number two?
Surprise.
So it's been a blessing for us, but, you know, Austin, it's a joke. You know, we're like, oh, man, we're dead. We're dying over here. You know, like, this is too much for us. But we're like, look, we can either be in business or we can be out of business. It's like, do you guys want this or not?
Yeah. So is it just like lines up? Because it's a very small restaurant. It's
yes.
Like in Dallas.
You know, the first week, it literally was like 2 hour waits.
Oh, my God.
Two and a half sometimes. And people were standing there for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
But it was fun because you get to see people mingle because we're BYOB. So people are in line drinking, waiting, sharing drinks. So, like, it was fun.
So it's a party.
That. Yeah, it was a party. Yeah. More like a celebration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your restaurant for those people who tragically have not been there yet.
Definitely. Our restaurant is a small Laotian cuisine. It's an interpretation of what my mom taught me, you know, as growing up as a Lao, I guess Lao's kid, I'm a Lao kid, you know, I'm still am. But, you know, really, it was just showcasing our culture, showcasing the food that my mom taught me, inspiration for her and for my travels, you know, just through Southeast Asia as well. Noodle shops, you know, scratch noodles made in house. Everything is pretty much made in house. You know, mm-hmm. Everything's crafted for our fans now, I guess, you know. But yeah, everything's made with love and care, and everything is made from my own interpretation, what I've grown up eating.
Yeah.
And like I said, we're only, what, 28 seats, 25 seats inside. Now we have a patio, so it's tiny.
Yeah.
Real tiny.
Yeah. So like every dish, you know, is getting like the full.
And the thing is, you know, everyone's like, it's a small portion tapas style. So it's, you know, where you can get the whole menu. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are like, what? We can get the whole menu? I was like, yeah.
Yeah. And you definitely should get the whole menu if you go there. Like, even if you're alone, as I was, order everything. And then be like, is there any specials? So, yeah. Can you bring two of each?
Yes.
Yeah. The restaurant, you know, the story of Cow Noodle Shop kind of like dates back to like before you were even born.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you've mentioned your mom already, but she's kind of this. You know, she's no longer with us, but she's this presence that's just there in everything that you do. Take us back to your mom's story. She was born in Laos and ended up in Thailand. I mean, I'll let you tell it.
Yeah. So my mom, you know, I call her Mang, which is the Laotian name for mom. So my mom, you know, her inspiration and cooking came from her mom's womb, I guess you could say, you know, all that good stuff, you know. No, so yeah, she was born and raised in Laos when my grandfather's French, and my grandma's, of course, Laos. Like, yeah, she's Laotian, right? No, but yeah, so my mom grew up a little outside of Vientiane, which is the capital of Laos. And, you know, for her growing up as a child, my great-grandma really was the one that wasn't cooking at home, you know, caregiver to her. And really, she just learned how to cook from my grandma and my great-grandma. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when the communist, you know, party came about and, you know, really pushing out the royal family, that's when things happened in Laos where a lot of refugees escaped from Laos because of that persecution. You know, if you're intelligent or you're a teacher, you're an engineer, pretty much they're like, look, with us or against us?
Yeah.
So my grandfather's, look, he was a big figure in his village at the time, so he told my grandma, like, look, you need to take the kids and leave Laos right now, because if not, they're either gonna capture you or maybe kill you. So, you know, my mom being, you know, pretty much like a teenager, you know, she's like, huh, what's going on, why do we have to leave? And literally they left overnight from Laos to escape to Thailand. They got on a boat. It was kind of, you know, kind of weird in a way, because you're like, back in the days, like, there was no emails, there's no phones, so like, how you coordinate this escape?
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Just like, get on this boat. Yes.
Get on this boat and leave.
Yeah.
Like, will we ever see you again? And my grandfather's like, I don't know. And literally, my grandma came with her kids, and she had 11 kids that she came with.
Wow.
Actually, one, 12, and one actually passed away. Caught pneumonia, you know, escaping through the jungle and onto the Mekong River to Thailand, and he passed away in the refugee camp.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was sad. And, you know, I've still, to this day, are starting to learn more about my mom's history and my dad's history. So I'm always continuing talking to my grandma. And sometimes, you know, she has dementia. So, you know, she's like, this is this. Like, but she has so much good stories and memories of what happened, and you know, all the old memories she remembers, but all the recent memories she really doesn't remember. But yeah, so you know, hearing those stories has kind of inspired me to, you know, getting close with my culture, get close with the food we do at Cal, because that's a part of, you know, what my mom was, my grandma, my great grandma, and so it's like I don't want to lose that.
Right.
So I want to keep that intact.
Yeah, and you said, you know, when your mom moved to Texas, which is where you were born. She was catering for a while, right? And then she was like, and then she got the opportunity to take over a restaurant.
Exactly.
It was a Chinese restaurant first.
Yeah, Ramen Garden.
So why Chinese? Like, what?
I think because, you know, like with her, just cooking at home was just her comfort and what she knew, you know, cooking for friends and catering to different shops. And I think her friend in San Antonio at the time was like, look, I love your food. You love cooking, right? So there's a, I think there's a friend that owns a restaurant in San Antonio. Would you want to give it a try to open your own restaurant? And she's like, maybe, you know, maybe, I don't know. And literally, I remember the trip, the car ride that we went from Amarillo to San Antonio just to go look at this restaurant. And this restaurant was massive. I'm like, what? It looked like a playground, seriously, for me. Being young, and she's like, yeah, let's go ahead and give it a try, you know. And she literally moved the whole family. My dad came, my brothers, and even her brothers and sister came down and to help out. And that restaurant literally had a dining area for about, I want to say about 50 to 60 people.
Oh my God.
Then had a downstairs, which was, you know, at the time, a smoking section, right? Like,
right.
You know, like, what? There's a smoking section?
Nice and then, Texas basement.
Yeah. And then in the back was a big old party room. I'm like, oh my God, this thing's massive. And, you know, just being that, in that environment, and being in that kitchen, see what my mom does. It was, you know, I had fun.
And your mom's just like, yeah, I've never run a restaurant before. Yeah, that sounds fun.
Like, yeah, I'm about to run this, you know,
a couple hundred a night
restaurant. Like, golly, you know, it's. But the thing is, it was just in a bad location.
It
was. But at least she knew that's something that she wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't try it, then you won't know it, right? So, she gave it a try, and she's like, you know, I kind of like this. You know, let's see what else is going on. And you know, unfortunately, we had to. She sold that restaurant off because just the location wasn't that great. Plus, it was Chinese food at the time.
Right.
Not her food.
No.
You know? There was a couple of Thai dishes, but not Thai dishes, right?
Yeah.
But she wanted to explore more Thai food because she loved Thai food. Because being in refugee camps, you know, experienced some of the Thai food as well, being in Thailand as well. And you know, she, you know, my mom just loved cooking. You know, French food. She was some. Her French food is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, oh my God, like, I can't compete that.
Yeah.
Her, and
she's
I
like, anything
can.
You want,
yeah.
I can make it. So that was not her last restaurant. Then she opened another restaurant, and then she opened another restaurant.
You know, it took a couple of Chinese restaurants.
Yeah,
you
know? A few Chinese restaurants under her belt, and then she got to the Thai restaurant.
Yeah, when I was 13 at the time, she finally found a restaurant that she knew that she can open up and introduce Thai food where it should be, not your typical, you know, Thai food that you eat at most restaurants. Because, you know, she studied Thai food. Like, she really, you know, flew to Thailand, talked to my aunt that lived in Thailand, and she was like, look, I love Pad Thai, but I really want to learn from the master, right? Mm-hmm. And at the time, I don't remember her name, the lady that does Pad Thai, but my mom's like, this is the Pad Thai lady, and I learned from her. I'm like, what?
Yeah, where in Thailand? She went all the way back to Thailand to meet this lady,
I was like,
right?
What? She was like, is there such a thing? It's like, yeah, so
the lady.
You know, just learning, just her inspiration about that, you know, learning something that she doesn't know, but going to the source and going to the master of it. Like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah. Like, and that's like incredibly revolutionary at that time too. Like what era was this? This was like,
it was, oh my God.
Early 90s.
Yeah, 92.
Yeah.
Early 90s.
Yeah. Like people weren't. Like, the average, you know, white guy on the street didn't know what Pad Thai was beyond oh, that thing I got to take out that time.
Yeah, so, you know, like, for her, that was her passion, her dream. I've eaten her food, right? I've eaten Thai food. I love her food. Her food was so amazing. But then I'm like, Mom, this is not the food that we eat at home, though. Like,
yeah, what is this?
You know, we don't get like, Pad See Ew at home and Pad Thai.
Yeah,
it's like,
what were you eating at home?
Lao food.
Yeah.
Which is totally different. You
know?
And because, you know, Lao food is, you know, it's so vibrant, you know, with different herbs and different spices, you know, it's funky, it's unique. You know, we use all the animal mm-hmm. from, you know, when a lot of people say from, you know, it's not to tell, we use in like more like the innards, you know, offals, liver,
way beyond snout to tail,
way beyond intestines, blood. You know, like that's the thing about Laos food. It's funky, it's crazy, but it's adventurous, but it's good, it's delicious.
Yeah,
and that's why I told my mom, like, why don't you put a couple of things on the menu to see if people like it?
Yeah,
she's like, okay, I'll, you know, put a sauce here and there, some sausage here and there, and people like loved it.
Really? Like right away?
Yeah, right away. Yeah. You know, like, see, this is, I love it because I eat this every day.
Right, it's like, finally.
Yeah, so now I get to eat at the restaurant, too, because I worked there, you know, helped her out after school, so
So what, do you remember what the first Lao thing she put on the menu that people went nuts for was?
Like her gel, you know, gel makua, which is the eggplant gel, you know, gel maklan, which is the tomato gel, steak of rice, you know, sausage, saua, you know, and that's just like the staple of what Laotian food, papaya salad, tamahung, you know, like, and the thing, our tamahung is papaya salad, but spicy, funky, and people are like, I'm not sure if I'm ready for this funk, but people enjoyed it, you know? And so that's the thing, it's like, try it.
Yeah, you know? Exactly, you'll love the funk.
Exactly, you love the funk.
So you grew up working in your mom's restaurant, and then, you know, at a certain point, she was like, you were around 20 or so, and she was like, all right, son, you're going to take over this restaurant? And what did you say?
I'm like, yes, I think it was a birthday present, I believe.
Oh, no.
Maybe I tell this to myself, I don't know. But, you know, that's a gift, that's a big gift. I'm like, but I don't want the restaurant. You know, like, I've been in this restaurant, you know, since, you know, 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And I've seen the goods and the bad. Mm-hmm. And that's part reason why, you know, I told myself, like, I'm not going to be a restaurant owner.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, see the stress and see the struggles and see how much my mom put into the restaurant. And for her to be draining each and every single day. She loved it. Don't get me wrong. She loved it. But the thing is, it was so draining.
Yeah.
It's hard to find people, and especially the type of food that she's making. Mm-hmm. Her intensity in the kitchen is like, everyone's like terrified of her. It's like, wow, my God, your mom's intense. Like, even the busboy was scared of my mom. Like, but you know, the thing is, she's passionate about her food, and she's a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. But you know, for me, it's like, yeah, I had to turn that down.
You were like, I don't want to own a restaurant. Yeah, why would I ever want that?
For me.
So tell us, what'd you do instead? And also, was your mom just like, cool, I'll just...
Yeah, your mom. I think my mom knew that it was going to be a lot.
Yeah, so she knew it wasn't like a guarantee.
Yeah, it was not a guarantee, but she was like, yeah, you should take it. I'm like, why are you hesitating? Like, you should or I shouldn't?
Yeah.
But no, so I turned it down, and I just kind of, you know, just trying to figure myself out. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually jumped out of like high school. I'm like, I'm done with school. I'm not a school guy. But, you know, my mom's like, you need to get something. Go back, get your diploma. I was like, oh, my God. So I went through night school, got my diploma. Yeah, like, okay, maybe I'll try college. A couple of years in community college. Didn't like it.
Yeah.
And then my bro's like, what are you going to do with your life? I was like, let's work. So I come work with me. I was like, okay, where? Fixing airplanes. Oh, cool. Really? Awesome. Like, heck yeah. You know, who would turn that
down? Yeah.
So, yeah, I traveled. I got seen so many places and tried different foods as well, too, from working in that aviation job. Well, it was just tiring, traveling, you know, 3 months, 6 months at a time.
Yeah.
Didn't see friends and family, came back. But all my friends like, oh, my God, you're making so much money now, huh? You know, all my friends still, like, struggling. And they're like, let's go to lunch. I got it. Like,
yeah, exactly.
They're like, what, do you have a credit card? Like, because I'm an adult now.
Yeah. See?
Yeah. This is what adult is, guys. Yeah. Don't go to school. Drop out. Be like me. No, I'm kidding. Don't be like me.
That's not the lesson here, kids.
Yes. But, yeah, so, you know, just jumping around corporate world. Aviation to, you know, I was a mail carrier for a little bit.
Oh, yeah, you loved that, right?
Yeah, you know, being outside, but it was rough. It's rough. I could see why it's intense being a mailman and being outside. And
yeah, it's one of those jobs that seems like it could be the best job or the worst.
Yeah,
job.
But you get to meet different people, so that's one good thing. Mm-hmm. And then I gave that a try for a little bit. And then I jumped into shipping, receiving, and then telecommunication, where I landed a good job at Samsung. Mm-hmm. And that was probably like my moment. I'm like, yeah, this is it. This is like my calling.
Yeah.
I thought.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I loved it because, you know, just at the time, technology was the thing, right? Cell phone was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, we could text people. We can email people. We like take pictures on our phones. Like, I want to be part of this movement.
Yeah.
So I did that for a long time and, you know, we got laid off. Actually stayed here in Queens, Jamaica, Queens, for a little bit for that job and got tired of it. You know, mm-hmm. one of those things and went back and just trying to figure myself out again.
Yeah.
You know, I loved working on computers, so worked at HP was my last job.
Oh, yeah.
In the IT world.
Yeah. And then at some point during this, your mom got sick.
Yes. So, you know, kind of skip everything. And then to my mom getting sick, it was her trip from Thailand and Laos.
Mm-hmm.
It was a trip that, you know, she's been about 3 or 4 months there. I haven't seen him for a while. And she came back and it was one of my best friend's wedding. And he's like, you know, we went to his wedding in Tennessee. My mom's like, you look tired, mom's like, you're like, yeah, I'm a little tired. I'm just jet lagged. It's like, mm-hmm. yeah, we didn't think anything of it. And after the wedding, we drove back to Dallas. And then she's starting to get yellow. I'm like, you kind of don't look right, mom. And jaundice came about. Her eyes was just yellow. And we took her in. Get a checkup. It took her like what 3 or 4 different times just to say, okay, there's something going on.
Mm-hmm.
So they literally just did some more testing and found out that she had a blockage in her bowel duct.
Mm.
I'm like, whoa. I was like, is there such a thing?
Yeah.
Oh my God, it was heartbreaking just hearing that. And then, you know, it's like, we'll go through chemotherapy, we'll go to radiation,
mm-hmm.
and then finally the oncologist like. This is a terminal cancer. I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
It's like, and there's only 1,200 cases in the United States. I'm like, wow. I was like, you kidding me, right? And it was just heartbreaking. And my mom, I'm like, huh? She's like, it's okay, guys. I'm here. I'm still alive. I'm like, Larry, this is where I became that baby of the family, the youngest child. I start crying. And
yeah.
I just broke down. I couldn't accept it. I'm like, no, this is not. My mom's like indestructible.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
She's a badass lady.
I'm like, she can run a restaurant by herself.
Mm-hmm.
And this slow freaking cancer is going to take her away from me. I'm like, oh, man. So, yeah. So, literally, the doctor says she has about a year and a half to 2 years to live. So, you know, the first couple months were rough. And mm-hmm. then we told her, stay with us. And she wanted to go back home to San Antonio. I was like, just stay with us. We'll take care of you.
Mm-hmm. You were in Dallas at the time.
Yeah, Dallas at the time, staying with us, just caring for her.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kind of went downhill from there. So she wanted to go back to San Antonio where she, you know, her home is, hospice care, you know, mm-hmm. and we're literally there. I took a leave of absence from my job, my brother as well, too,
mm-hmm.
and just spend time with her. Spent pretty much almost a year with her.
Yeah. That's,
you know, back and forth from Dallas to San Antonio. And finally, the last, 3-4 months, we just all came down, just like literally just stay in my own room,
yeah,
my own bedroom,
yeah,
and across from my mom, just, you know, spend time talking to her, cooking with her,
yeah,
and those was the moments. Like I wish that I had more time with her,
yeah,
doing that. But I'm glad I had those moments.
Yeah, and it sounded like, I mean, when we talked about this before, your mom kind of had a plan for when she was gonna have you come live with her and cook with her,
yeah.
She was like, you know that restaurant?
Nah, you're taking it.
Yeah. And you had kind of an epiphany yourself.
Yeah, because, you know, like for me, you know, it's like, even though I'm, you know, worked in a corporate world and doing different jobs, you know, I enjoy cooking. Mm-hmm. I really did, because it's just something that it was just natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand what natural means. Yeah. But, you know, like, it just came to me. It's like, I don't know. It's like, just I eat something, I can taste different ingredients in dishes. And my mom told me that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a gift. It's like, don't waste it. Do something you're passionate about, something you're going to enjoy in life.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of wasting your time trying to collect that paycheck or trying to buy the newest car or whatever.
Yeah.
And she's like, I see you're not happy. I want you to be happy. Do something that you're going to really wake up in the morning and be happy about.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for her, you know, those couple, 3 months was just more of telling me and coaching me, and, you know, not knowingly that she's planning something for me.
Yeah.
Like, you're about to own this restaurant. You just don't know it yet.
Yeah.
But no, literally, she set me on the right path, you know, mm-hmm. and that's something that I knew one thing that if she could give to me, that was that one thing to help me show me the way to what it means to be me.
Yeah.
Which is in the kitchen cooking for other people. Yeah. And that's in a day. My mom wanted me to cook for people and showcase my food to people and our culture and what she taught me. And that's the whole reason why my mom like, look, come here. This is the last dish I'm going to teach you how to make. And my wife was there and she's like, yeah, sukiyaki. Okay, cool. Sukiyaki. All right. And this is a painstaking dish.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
that was his version of it. Yeah. It looks like this beautiful bird's nest with like this tiny little egg on top.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. And that's the reason why I did that dish at Hot Tin, you know, because it was something that I remember my mom with that last moment with her making that sukiyaki dish. So, yeah.
Can you tell us about the dish?
The sukiyaki dish. All right. So the thing is, sukiyaki, it's not a Laotian name, right? So it's a Japanese name.
Yeah.
You know, Japanese colonized Laos as well back in the 30s, 60s, ongoing. But, you know, of course, they brought their ingredients and some of their dishes to Laos. And sukiyaki is pretty much a soup dish that we eat with a sauce, a fermented tofu sauce. Mm-hmm. You know, tofu fermented anything is amazing, right? And then it's that funk, especially tofu.
Funk.
A lot of people are like, hey, it smells like socks. But that's funky
delicious
socks.
Delicious socks.
Yeah, delicious socks. But yeah, so, you know, that's the base of it. And then you got your coconut cream that, you know, just stirred in for hours.
Yes.
You know, tahinis, sesame seed, peanuts. And that thing is just made with love.
Yeah.
Because why? Because you have to stir that dish like forever.
You better love it while you're stirring that dish.
Yeah, like, oh my God. Because my mom, you ask my wife, Noy, she's like, she told her, like, you got to stand there and stir it. I'm like, what do you mean? Because that's the thing, this dish, it has so much components to it. It'll burn at the bottom of the pot. And you literally had to cook down all the ingredients. You literally had to cook down all the
ingredients. How many hours are we talking stir-wise?
Oh, my God. Probably like 2 hours.
Oh, my God.
But
Noy is here. Yeah. Noy, did you have to make this dish in front of his mom?
She's a stir queen.
She's a great stir.
Yeah. No, but you literally, it's painstaking love. No, but yeah, so it's a good dish, you know. It's something that's delicious, funky in its own way, but you know, creaminess from, you know, coconut milk. It's just, I don't know, it's, for me, it's just delicious. You can eat it with anything, you know.
Yeah.
That's that dish, you know, with a poached koi, glass noodles, you know. And usually it's served in a broth, but I made it without broth. Because I believe the whole thing about that dish is that sauce.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why I made it into a more dry noodle dish with sauce.
God, I wish I was eating that sauce right now.
It's like, I know, where's all that sauce left over from the
event? Where's the food? So, all right, now that that's been described in great detail, and all of you are probably wishing that you were in Dallas right now, which is also our city of the year.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Huh?
Yeah, mostly because of Donnie. Well, thank you so much, Donnie, for coming here today. It was such a pleasure to talk to you always. I'd like to talk for several more hours, but I'm getting the sign that we need to wrap it up.
I know. Because
you have a flight to catch.
I know, right?
So thank you so much, and congratulations again. Number 2 best new restaurant, Cow Noodle Shop. Get there.
Kap Chai. Thank you, guys.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced and edited by Emma Wortsman, with additional programming help from Carrie Polis and Elise Inamine. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to reach out to us about this episode or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me and maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.